I'm Paul Wegraff, Director of the Delaware Division of the Arts and your host today for Delaware State of the Arts. Joining me by phone today is the violinist and artistic director of Seraphin Ensemble and the president and CEO of the Music School of Delaware. Yes, they are both the same person. Kate Ransom, welcome.
Thank you, Paul.
So glad that you can take some time out of your busy schedule despite COVID-19 to chat a little bit about the Seraphin Ensemble, and we'll get to the Music School of Delaware as well. But let's start with the Seraphin Ensemble. I know you had a really exciting festival scheduled for June of 2020, scheduled, I'm sure, long before the announcements came out in March that the state of Delaware basically had to close down in many respects. Let's talk about that. What have you been facing with COVID-19, and how are you adjusting with the Seraphin Ensemble?
Well, so Seraphin Summer Music had a great lineup planned for June 5th to June 20th. We had 7 concerts set up, really interesting, fascinating array of programming, including a lot of wind players this summer, and also just 19 internationally acclaimed artists coming to Delaware for that period of several weeks and the 7 performances. So obviously, like all the festivals all over the world, those have been canceled this summer, and we are going to present that same program plan in June of 2021. And of course, the artists are sorry to miss being in Delaware and playing together, but they all have their thumbs up to do it next year. So that's the first thing we had to decide, and with disappointment for ourselves and our audiences.
Now, what kind of logistical changes had to be made? I'm assuming, had some of the artists already booked flights and that sort of thing, or did they have enough warning?
They had. Some of them had made arrangements, but most of the airlines are honoring an airline ticket that during this time period that couldn't be utilized or was canceled for whatever reason. So they're usually getting the full value of whatever they had put forward in order to use it again later. I think it's mostly just, you know, musicians love to play together, and especially chamber music players. We live to collaborate. And so we miss the fact that we can't be together and do this and share it with our audiences. And we look forward to doing that next year. We are planning a Seraphin concert in August. And I am really looking forward to that, as are my 5 colleagues who will join me from around the country, Minneapolis and different parts of Georgia, for the Sibling Rivalry Summer Surprise. And it's going to feature 6 wonderful artists. It's 3 sibling pairs. Each pair is a violin, piano, brother-sister pair. And we have a wonderful program that we've had the pleasure of collaborating on for a few years now and presenting around the country. And we're going to bring it to Delaware on August 22nd for hopefully a live performance, hopefully for at least a small live audience. But we're also, with the ticket purchased for that event, anybody can access a virtual presentation of the concert a few days later on August 25th.
Now, I'm assuming then, if you're permitted to do a live performance, what sort of considerations are you taking into account for the audience based on any, you know, phased-in reentry that the state implements?
Right. We'll have a plan for how the audience will be handled. Of course, we'll follow all the protocols that we have in place already at the Music School of Delaware, which is where the concert will take place, in our concert hall at the Music School. And also, we will, of course, respect any limitations on audience size. So if they're allowing gatherings of 50 people, we will limit it to the first 50 people who sign up for the live concert. But in this way, by repeating it virtually a few days later, we'll have a high-quality, live-recorded concert that is presented as an event, and we'll have a host, and it'll be a lot of fun, too. We've already been dabbling with that at the music school and had some wonderful experiences already.
That's great. Now, these musicians coming in for the August program, Are they the same musicians that you were going to be bringing in June?
Well, so right now it does include the Coucherons, David Coucheron and his sister Julie Coucheron. David is the concertmaster of the Atlanta Symphony and a phenomenal virtuoso violinist, and his sister Julie is a virtuoso pianist. They're a Norwegian brother and sister who have settled in the United States and are pursuing their careers here. The other two sibling pairs are Michael Kim and Helen Kim. Michael Kim is the dean or director of the music department at the University of Minnesota and a wonderful pianist. And his sister Helen is the violin faculty chair of the string department at Kennesaw State University in Georgia. And then the last pair, the third pair, is my brother and me, William Ransom and me. And so he's the chair of the piano department at Emory University. And well, you know who I am.
Yeah. So, and hence, was it sibling rivalry that you mentioned?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And
it's a lot of fun. We have a program that we've specially designed that has some friendly feuding in it, and also allows each pair of siblings to show off some finesse and some virtuosity. But it's a really, really fun program for the audiences, very high spirited, and we think our Delaware audience will really enjoy it.
Now, I'm curious, and stop me if I'm getting too personal. Did you and your brother share the same music teachers growing up?
Well, we went to the same academy, not dissimilar from the Music School of Delaware. It was a pre-collegiate, non-degree granting school called Blair Academy of Music in Nashville, Tennessee, where we grew up. But he was studying piano, and I was studying violin. So, I would say we probably coached with some of the same teachers in chamber music, or you know, when we would play together. But obviously, we had separate teachers for our primary instruments. The Blair Academy of Music eventually became the Blair School of Music at Vanderbilt University, and that happened long after my brother and I were no longer living in Nashville.
Okay, and you've actually touched on something that some of our listeners may not be aware of. I know we've talked about it on the show, but just before, but just briefly. Seraphin Ensemble originally was a quartet, the Seraphin String Quartet. Just take a minute to talk about the evolution into the ensemble realm and what that's allowed you to do artistically.
That's right. Seraphin String Quartet started in 2001 and it thrived for nearly 20 years. The last 10 years of Seraphin String Quartet, we were the quartet in residence at the University of Delaware, and we really enjoyed that relationship so much. Working, coaching with the students there, leading the chamber music program forward, and playing a lot of concerts, and also collaborating with the faculty at the university. You know, things shifted at a certain point, and we were having a lot of challenges through, I would say, the last 10 years of Seraphin Quartet, trying to maintain our personnel, especially the viola position, was turning over too frequently, and it was frustrating, like starting over every time. So it just came time to do something different, and the model of the Seraphin Ensemble is actually a roster of 12 artists from all over the country, and these are colleagues and friends now of mine who have worked either together with one another, or obviously I've worked with all of them here, there, festivals and series around the country. And we love collaborating together. So basically we agree as a roster that when we have opportunities to collaborate, we will get together and do that. And we have developed a little bit of a repertoire now that we've played together, some pieces that we've played repeatedly. And as time goes by, that will increase, of course. But it's a wonderful group of musicians who have various roles in orchestras, on university faculties, and in other groups. One is a wonderful jazz bassist, Miles Brown. So everyone has their own role here, there, wherever they live, but they also all love to collaborate in small ensemble, small unconducted ensemble. And so that's our meeting ground in the Seraphim Ensemble, is our love of chamber music.
I have one last question about the Seraphim Ensemble. Is, I mean, during this COVID-19 period, opportunities for live performance obviously are greatly reduced, if not eliminated temporarily. Does this provide musicians an opportunity to take some time to perhaps explore and work up some new repertoire that they might otherwise not have an opportunity to do?
Well, certainly when we're not preparing for imminent concert appearances, that is a whole different kind of time for us to work in a different way. Mm-hmm. So we don't have the urgency of readiness for whatever's coming up next on the calendar. And I'm sure that each artist, each musician handles that opportunity in different ways. Some people maybe take a break. Some people do delve into revisiting their craft, maybe doing more studies, and some will learn repertoire that has been on the shelf that they've been longing to play, but they haven't had that kind of time, the luxury of the free time to start something new from scratch, which is a different undertaking from revisiting something you've played many times.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting how we're filling time that, you know, as performing artists is often preparing for a particular performance, and now, yeah, we're sort of shifting gears. Speaking of shifting gears, I want to switch over to talking about the Music School of Delaware. But let's first remind our listeners that you are tuned into Delaware State of the Arts here on News Radio 1450 WILM and 1410 WDOV. Our guest joining us today by phone is the Artistic Director and Violinist of Seraphim Ensemble, and now switching to the Music School of Delaware, Kate Ransom is also the President and CEO of the Music School. So Kate, let's switch to the Music School. I mean, suddenly in mid-March, you were told that you couldn't have students coming into the building. So this was, I'm sure, a shock to all of you as administrators, as well as to the teachers who would host both individual lessons as well as group lessons. How has the Music School adjusted? Because I've seen you're doing some really creative work.
Well, thanks. It's been a tremendous transition. The Music School of Delaware was not either outfitted, and our faculty were not particularly prepared for virtual instruction. So the first step we took was to try to acclimate our faculty to how to do that, and bring them along to a willingness to do that. I think pretty soon after the shutdown, the whole community, our staff, our faculty, and our board here at the Music School took in and understood that maintaining engagement with our students and continuing to deliver the mission of the school was essential, and that just because we couldn't do it in the way we might prefer to didn't mean that we couldn't do something meaningful. And so within 3 weeks from the governor's order, we had 85% of our faculty delivering virtual instruction. And already by then, we were developing ways to interact and engage with the large ensembles like the Delaware Youth Symphony Orchestra. And they've been so creative and so dedicated to figuring out meaningful things to do. For example, the youth orchestra has had master classes and sectional coachings virtually from our teachers and from members of the Baltimore and National Symphonies. They've worked in special session with a Grammy-nominated composer, and they've had a session with our music therapist about what it's like to cope with isolation. And one of our faculty members has done a session on music and dance related to the music that they're playing. So the creativity has been enormous. The dedication has been phenomenal. And it's really helped us make a meaningful transition to keep so many of our current families active and engaged. And this, at this time, that may be more important than ever. You know, parents and young ones are shut up at home. So spending their time in meaningful ways that are is inspiring and engaging is all the more important.
I'm curious because I know you have a track record of teaching children from preschool to seniors. I think you have some students in their
teens.
How you mentioned 85% of your teachers pretty quickly were teaching online. What about the students? How has that what's that retention been like? And do you see differences generationally in their ability to adjust?
I think it varies depending on the program. So, for example, we have a very high percentage of our Suzuki Academy students and families and faculty still actively engaged in what they were doing before. And we have certain faculty members who were very conversant with using virtual or distance learning methods. And so we've also tapped them to help the other faculty learn to do that quickly. But yes, it's the span of activities. So the community orchestra has had sessions with their conductor on score reading and how to program a concert. They had an Ask Me Anything session with their conductor. And they've had some sectionals or sessions where they do like an open mic, so they play their excerpts for one another and get a little critique, so they get tips from the conductor and from others. So it's taken creativity and adaptability. But, and even in our early childhood program, the same thing applies. There are activities that can be done virtually and that can help parents engage with their student, with their children, even at a very young age, and keep music in their day, in their daily lives.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't stop there. We're innovating as well in terms of, we thought to ourselves, how can we potentially tap new students in this situation? And isn't this a time when people might like to try something, an engaging activity that maybe they haven't had the opportunity before, but now they're shut up in their home, perhaps they have the time to do it. So we rolled out a couple of new things. One is a virtual lesson six pack. It's like a sampler for someone trying it for the first time. It's only for brand new students. It cannot be for someone who's already enrolled. We had 17 people enroll in that and pay tuition for that. And now they're reaching the end of their first six lessons and they've asked about renewing. So it's been a very successful experiment and obviously providing something meaningful. We also did about five or six classes, so six sessions, a six pack of music classes, and those, several of those are running. So other than that, we went on to try to do activities for youth and activities for adults that are single session offerings. Some of them are free, some of them are a modest price like $10. And we even included a music therapy session, a relax to music stress buster.
That's great. Before I forget, where can our listeners find out more information about the Music School of Delaware?
Oh, at our website. So it's musicschoolofdelaware.org. And all of the information and descriptions of these virtual classes is available there.
Yeah, we've got a couple minutes left. So I have a question for you. As we're talking here, I'm remembering back to my piano lessons when I was in grade school with Mrs. Mayer sitting on the edge of the bench with me, not only listening to me play and clearly observing that I hadn't practiced as much as I should have, but also paying attention to my hand placement and my curved fingers and all that sort of thing. What does a typical virtual lesson look like between the teacher and the student?
Well, it is different. And obviously the teacher can't actually physically manipulate someone's posture or position or their hand position. So there's more explaining mm-hmm. or demonstrating, like, let me show you how to position your fingers. And then the student looks at the split screen to see what the teacher is doing. Right. So it's very similar to when you do a Zoom meeting and you have two people on your screen or more people on your screen, but in the case of a private lesson, two people on your screen. And it is different, but a lot of our faculty are reporting that the process of learning seems to actually sink in for a lot of students more readily, they retain the information from week to week, and some of them are actually progressing faster. So we're learning so fast about the capabilities and the limitations of virtual instruction. But I think this is all a whole new universe that is opened up to us now, and it's not the future, it's today. So we're just trying to do what we can with what we have in the present.
Well, and what you're alluding to is one of the unintended consequences, and that is professional development for your teachers. Thinking about different ways of offering instruction, which I think
that's correct too. Yes, we're all learning a lot from this whole experience.
Yeah. Well, Kate, we're running down to the end of our time here. I really want to thank you for joining us today. I know you're busy with the Music School of Delaware. It's still operating full throttle and making plans for Seraphin Ensemble to do as much as they can. Again, I appreciate your time. It's been a pleasure chatting with you today.
Thank you.